go back to some of Billy's early years, and we're also going to go over his early contacts with Ascot. Billy's, of course, most well known for all of his contacts with the Pleiadians, which began in 1975. And few people are aware, actually, that he had contacts almost throughout his entire life. And that by the time the Pleiadian contacts had started, Billy had already had years of contacts with another race and with other people, and been on many adventures which had served to educate him up to this point so the contacts with the Pleiadians would really be possible. Kind of an interesting side note, I want to give you a little background into Billy's early life. On an earlier tape, we discussed his early contacts with Sfaf, the old Pleiadian man who had kind of helped him through his early years. He had caused him to be born at a certain time and saw to his early education, and had also taken Billy up for his first ride in a spaceship. Well, Billy's young school years were plagued with problems. You can almost imagine a young person in school that is having visitations from highly evolved extraterrestrial beings. It's very difficult then to go back to the schoolyard or the classroom and deal with mundane things like reading and writing when your mind is filled with far-off things of the universe and complex philosophical and spiritual philosophies and ideas that are running through your head. So Billy had a lot of difficulty really dealing with being an average child. And because of this, he spent a lot of time just being absent from school, from wandering out in the forest, thinking on his own, being led out into nature to discover and to observe more about nature and its laws. Because many things were going through his head, because he was constantly receiving telepathic transmissions from Sfaf during these years. Well, what happened was Billy became kind of the, the town juvenile delinquent. That's what they thought of him. He was always skipping school. And anytime something would go wrong or somebody would complain about something, like maybe something missing from their house or something, they'd usually blame it on young Billy right away. Billy, for some reason, had trouble defending himself. Whenever he would be questioned by the local authorities about, what his connection was, maybe with a certain crime or problem, Billy somehow would just keep quiet and not even answer. And he always felt it kind of unusual himself that he wasn't able to do this. But it got him in a lot of trouble. As a matter of fact, he landed in young men's institutions on a couple of different occasions because he just wouldn't speak up for himself, and he was assumed guilt in many cases. He even remarks that in some cases he would go ahead and sign the police reports, knowing full well that he had nothing to do with the crime that had been committed, but found himself still incarcerated in some sort of institution for the, the young insane or the young troublemakers. He finally wound up in what's called the Renault Clinic, which is a clinic for people who are psychically disturbed, where psychiatrists and psychologists can observe people. He was kind of young for that, but apparently too many days and weeks alone on the street and so forth led him to too many problems, and he wound up in this Renault clinic. Well, not wanting to stay there, Billy devised an escape plan. And what he did was he made a little key out of some wood that there was kind of like a wooden throw rug in his room. He devised a little key out of that, and one night he broke out of the Renault clinic by getting through a window in the bathroom. He had to drop about, 20, 25 feet to the ground below, which was concrete. He did, and in doing so, he twisted his foot and badly injured his foot. At the time, he felt it was probably broken. It's 11 o'clock at night, and it's, I believe it was in November. It was very dark and cold outside. So he jumped over the fence and got away, left the clinic. About that time, he heard the dogs and the sirens going off. Someone had detected that he was missing. They were looking for him. Billy ran through the woods and came to the Rhine River and dove in the river, thinking there was no way they would expect him to dive in the river on a cold, wintry night and swim, but he did. And he did make good his escape. He swam down the river for a ways. Must have been awfully cold. When he got out of the river, he stopped, ate some grass and leaves and so forth. He had spent so much time in the forest, he was beginning to understand what to eat and what not to eat, and knew a lot about nature. Ate some plants or whatever that he had found there, and made his way out of the country and traveled for several months. Actually, he snuck out of Switzerland and made his way all the way across the country into France, where he joined the Foreign Legion. It doesn't say exactly what the date or the year is in here, but he managed to join the Foreign Legion. And at that time, when he got to France, his foot was, which was really troubling him still, he got some medication and some help with his foot. And the Foreign Legion then packed him off to Algeria. Well, he wasn't in the French Foreign Legion too long when he decided this was not for him, and he already started to plan his escape. He was told by the other legionnaires not to even consider it, because the remote area they were in, he was miles and miles from any kind of civilization, and surely would experience the greatest trials and tribulations if he tried actually to strike out on his own across the deserts, because there were no oases, there was no food and water, and he would surely perish. So Billy looked at it as like, gee, this could be a living hell. So he decided to abandon the idea, is what he told everybody. But so everybody left him alone on that thought and didn't expect him to follow through on those ideas. However, secretly, he was still planning to do it. He did make good his escape one night and spent 2.5 months crossing the dangerous deserts in Algeria to get back to any kind of civilization. During this time period, he almost died on several occasions. Telepathically, he was encouraged in a couple of occasions by Ascot, who at that time was his newfound teacher, who told him and kept encouraging him to go on, to fight it, and to make it, and he did. Well, oddly enough, he fights all the way back, gets back to Europe, and decides to turn himself into the police and confess everything that he's done, draw a clean slate of it. He does this and is immediately put back in the Renault Clinic again, where a Dr. Rosselli, or R-O-S-S-L-I is how I believe it's spelled in the contact notes, conducts an interview with Billy to see, check him out. The doctor listens to Billy's strange stories because Billy's telling him all about what's happened to him, about his contacts when he's young, his visitations with Ascot, his telepathic things. And the doctor doesn't seem to be too overwhelmed with all this, but yet he doesn't write any of it down. Billy is then brought before the judge and is offered a chance to explain everything and to perhaps maybe even get off it again. He's not able to defend himself and instead finds himself just standing there at the mercy of the court with no defense. He is given 4.5 years in jail for his actions. And he spends that 4.5 years in that clinic and other places where he says he learned a lot about himself, life, and it was a great time to spiritually grow through his telepathic transmissions from Ascot. So he had a rather rough childhood and teenage year start getting going. At that point, though, he actually finally leaves Switzerland and spends about 12 years on the road going through foreign countries, and which brings him up to where he meets his wife in Greece later on. He meets her in Greece on December 25th, on Christmas Day, 1965. Previous to that, he had spent years on the road, mostly in India, Pakistan, and those areas, working in all sorts of odd jobs and so forth, getting along. His contacts with Ascot now, which is what I really wanted to get into, but I want to give you a little background on Billy's teenage years. His contacts with Ascot actually begin on February 3rd, 1953, on his birthday. That's when the sound of Sfas's voice left him. Ascot's voice then came into his head and has been guiding him since during that time period. It's his travels and teachings with Ascot which are most fascinating and prepared him for the Pleiadian contacts. So I want to tell you a little bit about those. Okay? He meets Ascot on February 3rd on his birthday. It seems that most major occurrences in Billy's life occur on his birthdays. He was told even by Sfath earlier times that his birth was quite significant on February 3rd, that very few people were actually born on February 3rd, 1937 at that time, at the exact point at 11:20 in the morning. And they seem to be very adamant about that was a very important time for people to be born, and anyone that was born right at that moment or very close to it would be very, very special people. It has something to do with this new age period and this jolt of new radiation energy that hits the planet and will cause increased awareness. So his telepathic transmissions from Ascot begin then on February 3rd, 1953, and it's not till his birthday on February 3rd, 1956 that he actually meets Ascot. About 16 days previous to his birthday, he is sent a telepathic transmission by her that she's coming, that they will actually meet. he's familiar with the location where they're going to meet, because it's a place that he likes to go frequently, where he would just kind of be alone with himself and contemplating his life. So it's very cold the morning that he sets out for this contact. Sun's just been up a couple of hours, and it's freezing cold in February in Switzerland, high in the mountains. Billy goes out for his contact to meet Askin. He climbs high up on the hill where they're to meet, and he's very, very cold, and he notices suddenly this shiny little, this looks like a little ball shooting down from space. It comes down very swiftly and just then stops, and then gently just floats slowly down to the ground. And it's kind of, it's a shimmering color, kind of silvery color, and it's a flying disc. So no one gets out, and Billy feels somehow compelled just to start walking towards it, which he does, finds himself just floating or lifted right up inside of the ship. He's surprised once he gets inside of the ship. There's no one there. There's just one seat, and he's alone. But he's guided then to set in the seat, which he does. Somehow he just has the, I suppose that Askett's guiding him telepathically at this point. He sits down in the seat, and no sooner does he do that, then suddenly the thing seems to start moving. He doesn't feel any sensation of movement, but he sees in the screens in front of him, which are projecting the outside view, that he's slowly lifting up off the ground, and he's floating over the general area. He feels telepathically Askett come into him, calm him, and explain that she will meet him, that the ship will bring him to her. He finds himself floating right over the home of his parents, where just for a brief moment Askett is giving him some reminiscence about his parents, his childhood, and she's given him a rough idea a little bit about the family that he's going to have in the future and what his life will be like. Billy notices something really strange, though. He looks down and notices that the ship is dissolving all around him. It just becomes invisible. Then he looks down and sees that he is also invisible. He looks around and he doesn't see anything. He's just in some sort of invisible form, and he looks like he's just floating in the air. Well, the ship, or whatever he's in, this ship that has become invisible, immediately moves way up high into the sky, and Billy finds himself just kind of looking at the stars. He's floating kind of half up in space, and he notes that there's a half moon out that particular night. Well, the device, the flying device that he's in, rapidly accelerates across the country, and he finds himself looking out over the Indian Ocean. The sun is bright and is coming up over the Indian Ocean, and just as rapidly as this flying device has gone up in the air, it rushes down towards the earth, gently floats down and lands, and Billy gets out of the ship and again just floats right down and is standing on the ground. He's not real sure where he's at. He doesn't see Askett. The ship is not there. He walks over to a giant rock that's there on the ground and puts his hand on the rock. He's surprised that the rock feels really warm. Something interesting happens, though. As soon as he touches the rock, suddenly he's aware of where he's at. He knows that he's in Jordan. Now, most of Billy's life, he's had the feeling that he's been here before. He quite often will be, in his travels, will know what's beyond the next turn. He'll be on top of a mountain and he'll know what's on the next place. It's like he's been to these places before but can't quite remember it. Combined with that, he feels kind of like a stranger on the planet, like he's visiting here. And ever since his days with Spath and that his mission was revealed to him, he's becoming more and more aware of the fact that he is an unusual creature in creation, that he somehow is on a mission, that he is just visiting this planet, that he has served in this mission several lifetimes beforehand. These things and these reminiscences are already starting to come back to him. And as he's standing here in Jordan and has touched this rock, these reminiscences are coming back to him even greater, where he feels that he has been in this countryside. Suddenly he knows the entire area, and he has this sensation that he's very familiar with all of his surroundings. Well, as he's standing there thinking, he looks up in the sky again, and here comes the ship of Askett. And again, it looks very much like the first one that he just rode in. It just looks like a silver line just darting in from outer space, and it comes down to earth very rapidly, stops, floats down, and gently lands on the ground. And finally, he's about to meet Askett. Haskett steps out of the ship, and Billy's a little taken back as she's very beautiful to him. She has very long white hair, kind of golden white hair, and she's wearing kind of a silvery-looking gown, not a flight suit type thing, but a very kind of feminine-looking gown that's tightly and kind of tied up at the waist and so forth. And then kind of an amazing thing happens. Billy, as he's walking towards her, he suddenly feels this, he's kind of overwhelmed with this sensation of love and concern. It seems that Askett now, being quite a telepathic person, also has the ability to project her feelings and her thoughts. And what she's done is she is, instead of shaking hands and saying hello, much like we might do, instead she projects all of her feelings and concern and love for Billy and pushes them right into his being. And every cell in his body, he said, is just kind of overcome with this immense love and caring that she has. He suddenly is just kind of like stupefied. He can hardly move. As well, he also at the same time feels very familiar to her. He almost recognizes her as someone that he's known before. There's this tremendous feeling, I guess, of deja vu coming over him, but he can't quite tell what exactly it is. She picks up on these thoughts and tells him to search his past life once again for the meaning to this. Not much is said at this point. They just talk for a few minutes, and she invites him to come with him right into the ship, which happens. Excuse me. They again float right up into Askett's ship, which is very similar to the one that he has just flown there in, except this one has three seats in it. They get into the ship, and they take right off, and she has not even explained where they're actually going. The ship lifts off the ground again, and again, just like the first one, it becomes invisible. And even though he knows he's still in a craft, a flying craft of some type, all is invisible. Even the ship, he doesn't see his hands or anything. He can't even see Askett. And she's not speaking. It's very quiet. The ship then darts across the countryside. And he notices again now, it looks like they're over the Mediterranean Ocean. And he's kind of surprised because he really doesn't know where they're going. And very quickly, the ship begins to come race back down towards Earth. And he finds himself standing in Egypt early in the morning. And as he looks down, he sees that the Great Pyramid there, the Great Pyramid of Giza, just outside of Cairo, and that the ship is coming down, and it looks like it's landing right next to the Great Sphinx. Well, the ship still looks kind of invisible, and Billy can't understand how all of this is really possible. And Askett says, well, it's time for us to leave the ship. And she senses Billy's bewilderment about the invisibility and explains to him not to worry because even though there are people milling around on the ground, the merchants and so forth that are up early in the morning, they can't see the ship either. And he really can't understand how this is possible. And she says, well, here, this will help. And she says, I have a little device you can put around your waist which will enable us to see each other, but no one else can see us. So she's putting this around his waist, and as she's doing it, suddenly Billy can see Askett kind of kneeling down in front of him, attaching this thing to his waist. And he's kind of surprised because now he can see himself, and now he can see her, but no one else can see them. They're just kind of hanging there in space because he can't even see the ship around him. So they leave the ship, and they find themselves standing on the ground there next to the Sphinx, and there are people milling about. She senses his thoughts again that he's challenging how this invisibility may be possible, and so she invites him, go ahead, try out touching someone, which she could feel in his thoughts he was thinking about doing. So Billy walks over to a couple of men that are standing there and walks around behind the fellow and notices that he's not being observed and tugs on the man's cape. And the man kind of turns, doesn't see anybody, doesn't see Billy, and turns back to speaking to the man he's speaking to. Well, Billy's just flabbergasted by this. How is this possible, this invisibility thing? They're walking along, and he's still thinking about this. They come across this tent. Billy ducks his head inside of the tent once more to test out this invisibility. When he looks inside, there's seven young women there and two older women. One of them has a young baby that she's nursing. Billy walks into the tent. No one is noticing him again. Now, in this type of world, if young women are in a tent, they would have surely noticed a man coming in, especially one that was sitting there nursing a child. And they're washing clothes. Askett follows Billy right inside of the tent. Actually, I should be calling Billy Edward now, because at this point in his life, the name Billy has not been used. And Ascot is calling him Edward, so I'll try to remember to call him Edward throughout these travels here, because the name Billy has not even come up yet in his life. That's not his real name. It's just a name that he adopts later on in life because of his fondness for the Westerns, and in particular, Billy the Kid. But his real name is Edward, his middle name is Albert, and his last name is Meyer. So he was born Edward Albert Meyer. And at this point in his life, as I mentioned, he's still being called Edward. So Edward enters the tent, and Edward is there with the seven women and the two elderly women. And for some reason, he just decides to test out this invisibility thing again. And Edward walks over to a young woman who's sitting there on a bale and who does not have any clothing on her top. Apparently, her clothes are being washed, and she's naked from the waist up. He gently kind of bends over and gives her a kiss right on the lips. Well, the woman jerks back a little bit. She doesn't see anything, but she's felt that she's just been kissed on the lips. And she looks a little bewildered and so forth and raises up her left hand to her lips and, like, you know, trying to figure out what happened. Well, her hand falls back down to her side, and Billy does it again. This time he moves in and gives her an even nicer, warmer kiss right on the lips. And the woman, her eyes just kind of roll back, and she's enjoying it. And suddenly, she just seems to kind of swoon and begins to faint, like she's going to fall over. Well, Billy catches her and helps her sit back upright. The other women in here aren't even noticing this. Okay, well, I guess if they can't see Billy, what would they notice? So the woman that he's just kissed, after a minute or so, kind of clears her head and gets her consciousness and begins to explain what just happened to the other women that are in the tent. And Billy hears Semyasi just kind of lightly laughing in his head. And so the other women swarm around her, and then Billy says, Edward says, what's going on, to ask it. And she says, well, that the woman has just felt like she's been kissed by an angel. And she's explaining that to all the other women. Billy goes over, and he goes to each one of the other women that he can get to, and he kisses each one of them also right on the mouth. And one by one, they're all excited and so forth. And as they leave the tent, Billy is, you know, remarking about, why are they all getting so excited? And, you know, will they think this is a strange experience? And Ascot remarks that, no, Edward, it's not a problem, that she had pushed into the thoughts of all the women that they had just been visited by a loving angel of luck. And now that their life surely would be better in the future, because it's certainly been hard in the past. So they all feel like they've had a wonderful angelic experience. So Edward somehow feel like he contributed to the welfare of these women who are washing clothes. They no sooner leave the tent, which is right next to where the Great Pyramid is, when Ascot leads Billy right into the side of the pyramid. Apparently, somehow with these devices, it doesn't say they go around and walk in the door of it. It's more suggestive that somehow they go right through the side of the wall and find themselves in these long, dark corridors somewhere in the deep part of the pyramid. They do not go up into the king's chamber or the queen's chamber. They are somehow down in the lower part of the pyramid in some dark hallways which are not accessible to the normal people and don't even know they exist. They move along these corridors. They're being very quiet, and still they're invisible. They come into a particular area where there's some big altar there. There's even a guard standing there, and Billy's a little surprised. And it's an armed guard of some type, a human-looking individual. And Ascot warns Edward and telepathically to be very quiet, that they're going to move right past this guard. They don't want to be sensed here, that there are descendants of an extraterrestrial race living down here below the pyramids. There are quite a few of them. She'll tell him more about them later on, but for right now, be quiet because they don't want to be detected. They seem to move right through another wall again somehow, and they're continuing down this corridor. They continue deeper and deeper and past several guards, and soon they come into a huge hallway, kind of a big open area. Billy estimates they're probably 300 or 400 meters down below the pyramid at this point. When they come into this large open area, Billy is surprised at what's down there. There's a huge flying saucer. A big flying disc is down there, a big silver one, way below the ground. It's possibly been there for hundreds or even thousands of years. Aska confirms in Billy's mind that, yes, that's true, that it's been down there a long period of time, that when the ancestors of these people came to the planet, they hide one of their large ships down there underground. And she's not sure exactly how long it's been there, but quite a while. Billy's looking around this room, and he's surprised to see also, over on a platform there, that there is a large cross that looks like the crucifixion of Christ. It's a large cross, about 2 meters in height. Also, there are some nails laying there. There is this crowned wreath with the thorns in it and so forth. There's a purple robe, and there's a little leather bag with some precious stones. And Billy, all sorts of things are running through his mind. He says, surely these must be the crucifixion tools of Jesus Christ. But he's a little confused because early in his life, Spath had taught him that the crucifixion was real, except that Emmanuel really did not die. And he was explaining to him all about the truth of what Christianity was really based upon. So he was really kind of confused because here was the crucifixion tools of Jesus Christ, and now he's really confused. He didn't know what was going on, and Ascot was offering no explanations at this point. They immediately, Aska takes Edward's hand and leads him back out of the pyramid. And it's been kind of a surprise to him when he comes outside. It looks like they've actually been gone for a couple of hours, and he thought it was just a few minutes. So he'd kind of lost track of how much time had been going on there. Well, they get back into Aska's ship, and they leave Egypt. And when they do, they fly back to the area in Jordan where the other ship is also waiting, and they land in this remote area in the wasteland somewhere, in the waste mountains and somewhere where the Dead Sea is at. Well, they spend 2 days there for Ascot explaining Billy all sorts of information. During these two next days in the ship alone with Ascot, this actually is the beginning, you might say, of Billy's mission. For the next 2 days, she explains many things to him about himself, his future, his life, and start to explain some very important things that he's going to need in his role as a prophet during this lifetime. One of the things they talked about was creation. He's slowly becoming educated through Spath and his recent experience under the pyramids with the crucifixion tools, more and more information about the life of Jesus Christ and religion. And she begins to explain to him a little bit about what creation is. And she just gives a few explanations here. She says, the universe, what we call a universe, this large thing full of planets, galaxies, and nebula, and all sorts of things, they call it creation because they regard it as a living thing, as an evolving thing. And she explains that he will become more and more knowledgeable about this, but she wanted to explain to him that the creation itself embodies the entire life of all living things in the universe. It is responsible for the existence of all things, including that which we call gods and all other forms of life forms. There is a creational force. The universe itself, then, is alive. It is an evolving form of energy. That originally the creation had the idea to create a universe, and it did. That idea then embodied all of the information that was necessary for that idea to expand and evolve into matter, which became the planets and all the galaxies, the universe we were in. So the creation actually is the life force and is responsible for all existence in the universe. And this is one of the main things, information that's missing on our planet, and that they really wanted to start teaching Billy because this would be an important part of his mission. She explains at that point that that was also the mission of Emmanuel during his time, that he was trying to explain to people about what creation is and about how life procreates and evolves throughout the universe, but they weren't really able to understand it, and most of the time they misinterpreted it. And that in the year 189, when Christianity would actually be formed, it would be somewhat altered in order to form Christianity. Nothing particularly malicious, I don't believe. They probably just did the best they could at actually understanding it. She also mentioned that it had been for 33 centuries that she and her people had been coming into our universe. She explained that she actually was not from our universe, that there was a neighboring universe they called the Dal universe, and that her race of people were called Timmers. Her planet that she came from was called Akon, A-K-O-N, and that for many years they've been coming into our universe. Their technologies have provided a way that they were able to build some sort of barrier or a canal or a cave, whatever you want to call it, that allowed them to come from their universe into ours. They'd been exploring for some period of time. They had found their way into the area of the Earth and finding human people here as well as on many other planets, and were involved in just as explorers and experimenting into our universe. She had also discovered long ago that the Earth people here on Earth did not originate here. And this led them to following or tracking down the origin of the Earth people, and it led them into the Ring Nebula of Lyra, which was the original home of the Earth human being. We've touched a little bit on this on our history thing that we talked about earlier, that roughly two-thirds of the white race of the planet Earth has Lyrian genetics in them, that we are from Lyra. So that was also mentioned. She mentioned that the Lyrians now were gone, that they had, through destruction and wars and natural events, pretty much become extinct, that there were very few of them left. Most of the Lyrians, 230,000 years back, during a very violent war, had left that section of the sky and founded what we now call the Pleiades. And that in Billy's future, remember he's only 19 at this time, that in Edward's future, he would have contacts with these beings from the Pleiades, but not for quite some time. That he was actually being prepared for that now. That Edward had been born on purpose in 1937 because he was a prophet. That he had served in that role many times before in other lifetimes. That prophets are born on purpose for particular missions, and they are generally procreated or caused to be born at particular times to serve their role as a prophet. Such was the case with young Edward. This is exactly why he had been born and why he was going through these series of contacts young in his life to prepare him for his role later in life to spread the word as a truth bearer. She also mentioned to him that it's a very difficult life. It's a very hard life, that a prophet is responsible for the truth, for bringing new truths to a society. And this often is quite difficult because many people are quite set in their ways and they really don't want to believe something else. So he could look forward to a very difficult life in front of him. She also mentioned to him that in the future he's going to write a wonderful book, and it will be based on some telepathic transmissions provided by these Pleiadians that he's going to have contact with later in his life. This entity will be called Arahat Athrasata. And it is the very same entity that Emmanuel was put in touch with 2,000 years ago when he learned his lessons of life. Out of this, he will write a very great book of truth, and this book could go on possibly to become a major epic to begin the new age with, as it will open up minds all over the planet and bring the truth about existence finally to the world of Earth. She commented again here that the truth really is not subject to change. That there are real laws in creation. When creation had the idea to create the universe, there were fixed laws involved with this. So the creation itself has purpose. It has total logic to it. There are reasons for things that we just don't understand. And this logic and this reasoning forms the basis for what they're calling the laws of creation. And she says, these laws of creation, Billy, will be made more and more aware of, but people should know that they're not changeable. Even though we may get off on a tangent making up our own rules of society or whatever, that eventually, in order for us to evolve, we must come back to the true laws of creation, or else we would just be spiritually stagnant, that evolution really would not be possible. Many, many, many races have ignored the laws of creation, become too materialistic, too warlike, and ended up just degenerating their society and being self-destructive because of war. The true evolution is only attained through discovering, knowledge, and living by the laws of creation itself. Next thing she mentioned was something kind of interesting, that we know in our solar system that we are taught that we have 9 planets, and we have an asteroid belt. She says that asteroid belt used to be a planet called Milana, that there were inhabitants, Lyrian inhabitants on that years ago, and that they came to a war and they destructed their whole planet and blew it up. When they did that, that planet used to be between the planet Earth and Mars. And when the planet blew up and all of it formed the debris which now forms the asteroid belt. It actually pushed Mars out of the orbit that it was in, causing life on Mars to be ended. It threw the planet Mars out of its orbit and caused Mars to be in a shorter, closer orbit to the Sun than it used to be in. So this is one of the reasons there's no atmosphere on Mars at the moment, and where all the people were killed. Apparently, the planet was violently thrown out of its orbit, and when that happened, all the life that was on the planet was thrown off of it out into free space, and the atmosphere disappeared, and all life on Mars ended. After that, there were only sporadic expeditions to Mars, and ETs occasionally keep equipment and so forth there. But at one time, there was life on Mars, and there was life on the planet Milana, which is now gone. She says, one of the main reasons that she is here on Earth is they had noticed that the scientists of Earth were coming very close to finding and discovering the answers to atoms and develop bombs and what they called destructive devices, which could lead very much to the same end. And that the particular position that the Earth and our solar system was in right now, it could be very dangerous to our whole galaxy and maybe even this part of the universe if we were to destruct the planet accidentally before 1974. For some reason, she was very clear that there was a clear and present danger of us blowing up our planet and causing major damage to the universe up through the year 1974, and it was her particular mission to come monitor the scientists of our planet and very carefully make sure that this did not happen. Along with the rest of her mission was to help guide and teach Billy many things so his mission as a prophet could be fulfilled. She says, currently right now, and this is back in, I think we're in 1956 here someplace, that America, Russia, and China were all kind of fighting for dominance of the world. Along with these three major superpowers, most people were not aware that the Jewish Zionist extremists were working very closely with certain elements of the Roman Catholic Church to cause terrorism and mass murder in many areas of the world to destabilize it. They also were fighting their own battle to gain control of the world without trying to taint their image that they had as being religious leaders, that they were undermining the general welfare and peace of the world by promoting terrorism and mass murder in certain areas and blaming it on other terrorist groups. That this action actually was being caused by the cardinals or chairs of Rome in connection with Jewish Zionist extremists. Another thing that she was providing to Billy was something, some events of the future. She said that now in 56 up through about the next 20 years, there were certain events which were going to happen, which needed to happen. Certain political and religious events, mostly political assassinations, that needed to happen in order for the world to be on its proper course. And she said she was going to describe these future events to Billy, and that he was not to tell them to anyone because they did not want to take any chance that these events somehow may go astray or not happen. It was important that they did happen. She didn't go into lengthy explanations why, but she said these events were necessary to happen in order for our future to become out, I guess, more peaceful or whatever. So here are the events of the future that were given to Billy back in 1956. The first one that she mentioned was Joseph Stalin, and who was then head of Russia at the time, and she said that he was going to be poisoned on March 5th, 1953, because he would be kind to the Zionists. Of course, that event had already happened by the time that these prophecies came along. But Nikita Khrushchev would be his successor, and he would be coerced out of office in 1964. John Kennedy would become the President of the United States, which he did, and would be assassinated on November 22, 1963. The interesting fact was that she commented here in Billy's notes that this was going to be by the order of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Now, here we are in 1992, and we're finding out it's becoming more and more clear in the public that the CIA somehow probably was involved in that, although we don't have any exact proof. Because it's also mentioned right next to that in his notes that Bobby Kennedy will be killed by the same order, by the same people, on June 6, 68 in Los Angeles when he's running as a candidate for president. So here we have some information from extraterrestrials prophesizing and being very accurate about the death of Kennedy's. says the Holy Office in Rome will also not be spared. Pope John XIII will be poisoned in 1962. Interestingly enough that he and Pope Paul VI, who will also be poisoned by cooperation with the cardinals and the Jewish Zionist extremists. Here we have the cardinals, or the holy chairs of the Catholic Church, actually plotting to kill their own pope. It's the cardinals that put the popes in power, and apparently they put one in they didn't want, and they conspired somehow with Jewish extremists to kill their own pope. In Greece, King Paul I will be poisoned on March 6, 1964. A lot of poisoning going on here, so apparently there's, I guess if you're into assassinations or whatever, there must be certain kinds of poisons that are undetectable that you can use. His successor will be named Konstantinos, who will be exiled in 3 years by a military regime. In Egypt, the land of the pyramids, Nasser then was president and leader of Egypt, but he would be poisoned by his own relatives in 1965. Again, there's poisons being used. In Saudi Arabia, King Faisal will be shot in 75. So here they're using a gun instead of poison. These were the most important events of the next 20 years, events that helped shape and form the political leadership of our planet. And it was most important, she said, that these actions not be interrupted for whatever reason. Okay. She mentioned that Askett mentioned that she and other extraterrestrials did not really have the authority, what they called the authority, to interfere with politics and religion. That authority wasn't by some laws that they had passed. They regard this as the authority of creation itself. They, their moral value, you might say, is that every life form has the right of its own path of evolution. That every individual has the right to a free will to make his own conclusions and do what he wants. And they regard the people of Earth as having free will. It's up to us who we elect, who we let lead us, and what we do about it. And it wasn't their responsibility to interfere. So they believe that it's not right for them to interfere in our politics and religion. They can give us all the advice they want, so we make our own decisions, but they don't directly get involved. She says one of the main reasons for her coming there, her mission, was to prevent these scientific catastrophes that they were so worried about. That since the atomic bomb, scientists had learned entirely too much, and they were really afraid of some sort of doomsday devices that may actually explode the planet. They said there was a window of opportunity open up through 1974 where the possibility was very high that scientists here on Earth would invent and develop bombs and destructive devices that could actually explode the entire planet, just like what happened to the planet Milana, ruining not only our solar system, but maybe having catastrophic effects on the universe itself. So she was particularly concerned with taking care of those particular problems, as well as she felt very strongly about her role in helping Billy prepare for his mission as a prophet. Now, I've mentioned these Bafath creatures a couple of times. We talked about Billy and his experiences going underneath the pyramids with Askett. Well, the people that were down there are called Bafath. And Bafath, you might say, are kind of a renegade Pleiadian group. About 75,000 years back, something like that, they split off from the Pleiadians and a different faction of them. They'd come to Earth, and they'd been trying to take control of Earth for a long period of time, but not really having the capabilities. Their technology is not as good as the Pleiadians. It's degenerated a lot. And they've gotten to the point now where even our own missiles and so forth could be destructive to their ships. Apparently their ships don't have the protective screens like the Pleiadian ships do, and they're not able to even protect themselves against our missiles. So they have to be very cautious. So they've taken to trying to control the world and so forth through mind control of different leaders. So she was cautioning Billy again about this. And then she explained to him the fact that the crucifixion tools that Billy had seen under the pyramid when he was down there with her, those were designed on purpose by the Bafath. They were not the real crucifixion utensils. The crucifixion did happen. But the original crucifixion cross and so forth had already long since molded off into dust and was gone. That these crucifixion tools Billy saw, or Edward saw down below, were fake. And they had been made on purpose by the Bafath because they were going to present them to a certain American named Reinhold Schmidt. and he would be told that these were the original tools of the crucifixion to stimulate and reinforce in him the belief about religion and Jesus Christ. And this would help to serve their interest, because people who believe in certain religions and belief structures devoutly and worship are easy to control. These are the sort of people that generally are willing to give up their free will and allow some other entity, power, or religion, or whatever, to be responsible for them. And they've learned a long time ago that these kind of people can be controlled easily, so it's become a standard MO or modus operandum with this group of people to always use the religions and Christ and God and so forth in their approaches. Ascot's also going to take Edward back into the past so he can learn for himself a lot about different historic times. And in particular, they wanted him to have his own firsthand knowledge about religions, about Jesus Christ, and different historic periods, so it would be his own knowledge. You know, when you hear information from someone else, that's just information. It's not your truth. But if you actually experience it yourself, then you have firsthand knowledge. It becomes part of your life, and it's your truth. So in this instance, they were always careful to take Billy and let him learn for himself, see for himself, so it became his particular knowledge. Well, they've been in the ship talking for a long time, and nightfall comes, and they decide to go for a walk. They're actually walking hand in hand. Billy's 19 at this time, and obviously very taken with this woman. You can understand why. And they're walking. There's a dim moon out, that dim light out that night. It's very pretty out. They go for a walk, and they're just chatting and talking. And suddenly, Ascot pulls Edward's hand and kind of stops him. And this fellow jumps up at them with a gun. And he's an elderly fellow, probably in his late 50s or 60, something like that. And he's pointing a gun at them. Well, they immediately calm him down. Apparently, they've stumbled onto someone's campfire here, and they calm the fellow down, and he finds out that they're not bad guys, and they didn't come to jump him in the middle of the night or anything. His name turns out to be Jitschi, and that he is from Russia, and he used to be a Russian diplomat or ambassador of some type, and he had taken to the road. This fellow Jitschi was now traveling for the road the past several years, and he was kind of out, you know, developing his own experiences. So they talked to him for a while by his campfire. Jitschi offered them a little bit of food and so forth, and they got to be very friendly. Well, Ascot turns to Edward and takes him by the hand, says it's time to leave now. They prepare to go. And Jitschi stops them and remarks how comfortable he is around them, that he doesn't get to see people very often, and hopes they would stay. Ascot tells Jitschi, well, we can't stay now, but we'll be back on February 7th, and we'll see you again at the same location. So he's happy with that, and they take off. So they go back to the ship. They return to the ship, and it's getting very late at night, and they stay again in the ship that night. So Edward stays there with Ascot again. And in the morning they get up, and Ascot has a little breakfast for them, and they have some kind of unusual juice he didn't recognize and so forth, and they have a little breakfast thing there. And she explains a little bit more about creation to Billy, to Edward, excuse me. He's still Edward at this point. She says that she's drawing his attention to the fact, and she knows that Edward is not particularly mathematical and scientific, but she explains to him that all of creation can be explained mathematically, that it is a totally logical evolution, that the creation itself is totally logical in every way. We just don't realize it because we have not discovered it yet. We have not scientifically advanced to that point. But she explains to him that there are the numbers 3, 7, and 12 are the important numbers. Now, I don't know too much about this either, but she says the entire mathematics of the universe consists somehow of an enclosed circle, which can somehow be conceived with the numbers 3, 7, 12, and 7 times 7. So for those of you who are into numerology, perhaps you already know these things and can probably better explain it than I could. It doesn't mean too much to me. She's being very careful with Edward all the time not to take any particular information too far, only to open him up to certain ideas and concepts a little bit at a time. And she acknowledges this again and says that she and ETs, they have to be very careful, you know, when they give information out so as not to overload us or, you know, give us things that really aren't useful at the time. Another major concern of Ascot's always was that if they gave Billy too much information, especially in the scientific areas, that it may find its way out into the scientific community, and they really didn't want this to happen. They see us as a planet anyway that's, you know, technically way out of line with our social development, where, you know, the majority of the planet's trying to eat and even have some health and find a home or some shelter, and then we have a small percentage of the planet, you know, which is very highly developed, so there's a broad difference between our scientific development and our social development. They have already watched us develop the atomic bomb and blow up Japan, and so we're very concerned about feeding any more information to our scientists, which could do even more damage than that. She's telling Billy a little bit about his future, and that later on that he will be directed to confront the Befath group, that they have a strong representation in Berlin through this Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E, that's been going on for hundreds of years. And it would be good for Billy to confront them at a certain point. When that happens, she warns him that his life will come in danger, that the life that he's about to lead, his mission in life as this prophet, bringing truth and so forth to the world, does bring a lot of danger along with it. After he confronts these Befath people, she says his life will be in danger, and it's about that time period anyway that it'll be necessary, for Billy to disappear for about a decade. His contacts are going to stop at that point anyway, because he'll be left alone for about 10 years or so, to 11 years, in order before the contacts start again, because these will be difficult, unusual times for Edward, that he will become married, and he's going to develop his family and settle down, and he's going to have to learn all this information that's being presented to him needs to become part of his life also. He needs to learn it and make it part of himself, have cognition of it, as they say, so it becomes part of him. In other words, what they're doing is they're educating young Edward, and now they're allowing him to spiritually grow through the use of this information to facilitate his role, his mission later in life, and that his contacts would start again in the first part of the year 1975. Well, Ascot tells Billy it's time, tells Edward it's time to leave now. They're still in Jordan. So she leaves, and Edward gets into the small ship that he came in, which is still parked there, and he returns back to home where he's started out. 2 days go by, and of course Edward's pretty excited, you know, because she's already told him they're getting ready to take some other time travels and into back into religious historic times, to back to the year 32, around the time of the crucifixion. So he's pretty excited about this. 2 days go by, and Billy once again returns to the same spot where he was picked up before. But this time Ascot comes in the ship instead of just an unmanned ship coming for him. And they return back to the same spot they were at in Jordan. And she explains that this time they're going to travel back into the past, like she told him, to increase Edward's education. And she begins to explain to him while they're waiting, while they're on the way to Jordan, a little bit more about his future. She says they don't normally tell Earth people about their future too much because they can't bear it. It's not good for people, for instance, to know about their lifespan, about who they're going to marry and so forth, because one of the problems is if they tell people, they'll probably mess it up. You may not agree with the way your future's going or the one that you have planned out for yourself at the time, and you may be able to try to make changes in that, which can have cause and effect on other situations. So normally, she says, most people can't understand and bear their future, and so they don't tell them. But they were telling Billy because in his life as a prophet, he's going to need to learn more and more about self-control, that he's going to have many hard times, many difficult times, and he's going to have to let them happen and go the way that they're going to go. He has to understand his future and actually live it the way that it's going to happen. At this point, Edward still has both arms, and she explains to him that he's going to lose his arm, even though she knows exactly when and where. She doesn't tell him exactly, because she doesn't want him to know the exact time. She just says it'll be between the 1st and the 5th of August in 1965, which it did turn out to be. Says at that time, right around that time period, that he will change his name and start going by the name of Billy. She says, you'll be known all over the world by this name, and unfortunately it's going to cause you lots of personal misery, which in a way it kind of has, because it's Billy now is fairly well known around the world, and it has caused him a lot of problems. He's had several attempts on his life, His family's been harassed quite a bit. His life really hasn't been his own, and only the last few years has he really tried to force his own privacy to kind of get his world back together. She tells him that he'll marry a 17-year-old girl in Greece, and that he'll have three children with the names Atlantis, Gilgamesh, and Methuselah, using the old names. And that he will have 10 years of very hard life before his next contacts are going to start, which will be in 1975. When these contacts in 75 start, which will be with the Pleiadians, she says around that time period, he will be invited to come to Germany to address a UFO congress there in Berlin. And once they find out, though, the types of things that he was going to say, the kind of truths that he's going to talk about, they'll cancel his engagement. They won't want him to speak because Billy's going to speak some very hard, harsh truths about life and religion, and this UFO group there is based all around religion. This is a UFO group who believes they've been contacted by ETs who are somehow sent on behalf of God. And they are, you know, believing this, and they are, you know, don't want Billy involved now suddenly in their operation because he's going to come and tell them the truth about creation, and they just don't want to hear that. She said it's also important that no one uses the name that Billy had been traveling by in Persia, which was Phantom. Apparently, even though his name was Edward, on his travels around and so forth, he was using the name Phantom for some reason. Now, I don't know where that came from. But she told him from that time on, from 1975 on, he should never use that name again. He should only use Edward and Billy, which will be his new name at that time. At that particular time of the contact, she said that there was 2.7 million people on Earth who had seen a UFO. There were 3,104 Earth people who had actually had contact with extraterrestrials. Most of these contacts were telepathic. Some of them were actually physical contacts. There seem to be, around 3,000 ships a year come into our atmosphere. A very small percentage of those really have very much interest in us. They just kind of look over the planet or stop and get something, pick up whatever they might want. But a few of them actually will have some physical contacts from time to time with Earth beings. These will generally only be one time or two times because they're just passing by. They very seldom ever lead into anything, on running. So there aren't really that many people out there that have, actually had contacts with the ETs. She said also, beginning in 1964, that he would start writing down all of his contacts. And again, we're still in 1956 here. She told him beginning in 64, he'd start writing them down. And it would be with the help of the technology from extraterrestrials that he would continue to have meetings, contacts, teachings, and so forth, just like was going on here. It wouldn't be necessary for him to take notes and write them down. That the extraterrestrials, and in particular Ascot, had the ability to store all of the thoughts and words and feelings in their own subconscious. And they had devices on board the ship which could recall these words, thoughts, and feelings from their subconscious at any time, and they could forward them on telepathically to Billy so he could actually write down all the notes from his conversations. And this is what did happen over the years. When Billy's contacts with the Pleiadians started, that's exactly what they did. He would be on board a ship. All the thoughts, feelings, and words and so forth were recorded into the subconscious of Semyasi. And later on, their devices would actually pull these thoughts back out of the subconscious and telepathically send them to Billy so he could type and write down all of his contact notes. Well, they settle down and go back to sleep again in the ship, which they do. They spend the night again in Ascot's ship there in Jordan. And they're woke up in the morning by a gunshot, which they're kind of surprised. And Billy looks outside, and there's Jitchi standing out there with a rifle. Well, this is kind of a surprise. They come out of the ship, and here's Jitchi, and he, of course, is greatly surprised to find this big silver beam ship, or I guess you should just call it a flying saucer here, because it's not a beam ship type drive. Ascot's ship were different. So they have to go through this process of explaining things to Jitchi. Jitchi, of course, gets very excited, and suddenly he says, "Oh, God, you guys must be from Venus or Mars or something." And Ascot's saying, "Surely we're not. We're not from there at all. There's no life forms on Venus or Mars." And Jitchi's pretty excited, as you might well understand. And he thinks Edward and Ascot are probably both ETs. And Edward's informing him, no, that he's an earthworm just like him. and he's from Earth, and that the lady asked it, you know, is an extraterrestrial. Well, Jitsi thinks she's an angel right away and says, oh, surely you must be here on behalf of God. And he pulls his Bible out right away and is saying, oh, look, I believe in God, I believe in Jesus, and I study the Bible all the time. And Askett's a little taken back by this and begins to explain that no, that she or no extraterrestrials come on behalf of God, that any extraterrestrials that claim that are just being deceptive and very wicked, and they shouldn't do that. So they go through this process of explaining all about who they are and what they're doing, that they're getting ready to take a trip. Well, this kind of throws Askett off. She wasn't expecting this at all, for Jitsi to turn up right here and doesn't know exactly what to do about it. So the opportunity is extended to Jitsi to come along with them, that they're going to be making some travels and jumps and going different places. And Jitsi, of course, says, no, he doesn't want to, that, you know, this is against God, it's blasphemy, and he's going on about this. And Edward jumps all over him about being a coward and what good is your Christianity if you have no control over yourself. And they get into kind of a word thing going there. The outshot of it is that Jitsi decides, okay, he will come along, by golly. So they say, all right. So they move towards the ship, and Jitsi goes first. They push him up into the lift, and he goes up in the ship, and they come up after him. And there's poor Jitsi. He's just pale white, and he gets so sick, he vomits, unfortunately, in a little bag that he has with him. And Askett has to calm him down, and suddenly Jitsi remembers that he left all of his stuff back at his camp, and they let Jitsi go get his stuff and return, and then they take off. Well, they're in the ship, and they're getting ready to lift off from Earth again. Jitsi is still just pale white, doesn't know what to make of all of this. He's about 59 years old, by the way, and spent most all of his life studying the Bible. And now suddenly he's hears these people telling him that everything that he's learned so far is wrong, and it's making him ill. And this could be a very good example of what they're talking about if the extraterrestrials were to suddenly make themselves well known and provide, you know, irrefutable proof that much of our belief structure is wrong. It can be very, you know, seriously affecting on many people. It can make them ill in thought. It'll literally just drive people crazy, and that's exactly just about what's happening with Jitsi. And now they're in the 13th century. Edward's standing out on the ground, and he immediately starts to kind of notice nature all around him. First thing he notices is there is a larger abundance of birds and so forth in the air. The air itself is more cleaner. The oxygen content seems to be a little higher, cleaner, easier to breathe. You feel a little exhilarated, he said. And they're in France at the time of Louis the Saint, and they're going to visit a rabbi by the name of Gicelli. Also, the sky looked a little bit different in color. He remarked how the blueness of the sky was more blue and clearer and cleaner than he had seen it before. And he's still living in Switzerland in 1956, which is a pretty clean place. So going back several hundred years, before we started filling the air even with industrial pollution, things looked a little better. So they're somewhere in the woods in France, and Askett leads them on, and they move through the forest a little way, and they come across this little house, and she's telling them that she's been here a couple of times before, and she has a friend here. And they're look around, there's a horse in the barn, and suddenly a bearded fellow comes out the front of the door, and it's Gicelli. And he's a real happy, friendly type people, and he's waving and so forth, and he comes over, and he's happy to see Askett. Oh, hello, so nice of you to come again. And he says, are these your extraterrestrial friends? And Askett says, no, these are Earth people just like yourself, but they're from the future. Well, this doesn't seem to shock Gicelli too much. He just kind of takes it in stride and comments that, oh, how wonderful, I wish just once that this beautiful lady would take me for a ride so I could experience some of this. But it isn't explained why Askett has been there two times before, but apparently she has, for whatever reason, to see Gicelli. Gicelli is already known in the area as kind of a magician and a person who fools around with unusual things and so forth. So right away, he notices Edward's lantern that he has with him, a little electric lantern with a light on it. And he asks him about what that is. So Edwards explained it to him. He says, well, no, it's not really like a lantern. It doesn't have a candle or a wick in it, and it doesn't run on kerosene or oil or whatever. It runs off of electricity. And he's showing him, and he pushes the button, and the light comes on. And Gicelli says, well, this is marvelous. This is wonderful. You know, how does this thing work? And Jitsi remarks that he knows a little bit about electronics and would be happy to spend a few minutes explaining to Jicelli how the thing works. And they say, fine, you go ahead and do that and ask it, and Edward wander off someplace else. And Jitsi and Jicelli are kind of hanging out together for a while. And they come back together in a few minutes, and Jitsi says, he has to ask it. He says, listen, I've got some things here that belong to Jicelli that he gave me. Can I take them back with me? And she says, sure, I guess if you want to. And he says, this would be great. Then I would have, like, antiques from the 13th century France to be worth a lot of money. And Edward jumps on him again about being a materialist, and he says, oh, you're having this fascinating experience, and all you think about is making money. And they get into it again. So Ascot explains to Jitsi that, well, they really won't be antiques. I mean, they won't age, because once we get into the ship and go back, that there's no aging. That it'll only take a part second for us to return from where we are at back to 1956. So no aging will take time on this, whatever it is that you want to take back. Even though it was made here in this time, it won't show any age on it. If you really want it to age, she says, bury it somewhere here in France and then come back and get it when we get back. And then it would have aged, you know, at several hundred years' time since he buried it. So Jitsi understands that, but he takes the stuff with him anyway, and they leave the 13th century. It says in Edward's notes now that for the next 6 days, they travel to different time periods. They observe different parts of history. And each time they make one of these jumps and so forth to different time periods, Billy's starting to notice already this unusual feeling he has. Every time there's a jump, he somehow feels a little better. And he comments in his notes that there's a calming effect. He somehow feels a little better about himself, and he kind of uses the word like uplifting. You feel a betterment of yourself or something. Well, you know, earlier we talked about the time when Billy got to go on the Great Spacer and experience eternity for 7 minutes. The same thing's happening here. He just hasn't quite picked up on it yet. But he's already sensing that just for the brief part second there, that your spirit is in touch with creation again when you're in the fine matter world. And there's this slight feeling of exhilaration that he can feel, which is apparently a surprise to the Pleiadians later on, because they say that most people can't feel that. They're not that sensitive to the sensitivity of creation as easily as Edward was. Well, one thing that starts to happen is they're going through all of these jumps over the next 6 days' time. Jitsi, who's still carrying his Bible along, is going through it all the time and making notes and changing things. And his opinion about religion and history is starting to change because he's seeing for himself historically what really happened as opposed to what's actually written down. And in most cases, in defense of the Bible, it appears that it was pretty much the same thing. There were just certain things that were, you know, different here and there. And mainly the thing about Jesus Christ is becoming more apparent to him, that it didn't actually happen exactly the way that Christianity has written it. And it's becoming more apparent to him all the time that the Jesus Christ never really did exist. Frankly, there never was a person named Jesus Christ. There was a man named Emmanuel who lived the life and times that we hear was Jesus Christ. But it wasn't until the year 189 that they took the life, teachings, and times of this man named Emmanuel, changed the name to Jesus Christ, meaning the Anointed One, and Christianity became alive. It was actually formed at that point. But there never was a man named Jesus Christ. That's just what it says now in the Bible, the way that we read it. But bear in mind, the Bible's been changed many times down through the years. One other comment is there, at some particular point, Billy seems to be wandering around in his thoughts about different things, and one of them was about the Great Pyramids of Egypt. And Ascot picks this up in his thoughts and tells Edward, I keep calling him Billy, tells Edward that I feel that you're curious about the pyramids. And she said, time-wise, they were built 73,300 years back from today. And they were built when the star sign of Lyra stood in Cancer. And they were actually built by the descendants, she says, of the Earth people, which would mean they were built by old Lyrians sometime back in there. Some descendants of the Lyrians built the pyramids. And by the way, there's, she says, all of the pyramids, because not only is there a great pyramid of Giza outside of Cairo, the one that we're familiar with, but there was also two other ones. And when they built them, they built three. They built the large pyramid of Giza there. They also built one in China somewhere that's way below the surface of the ground, and it'd be a long time before we're able to ever detect it and understand that it's there. And then she remarked there was another one. And it doesn't say so in the notes, but Billy was telling me about it. And I'm not sure if he told me it was in South America or Central America. But there's another one somewhere in the southern part of the Americas that's just below the surface, where the very top of it, it's totally preserved below ground. And the top of the pyramid is just below the surface of the ground. And we should probably run across it most any time. We'll probably find it. She didn't want to elaborate at the time as to why the pyramids were built because, again, she felt this was going too far, that for the average person, it wasn't time to introduce knowledges to them about pyramid power. Now, there are many people over the years that have experimented in learning more and more about pyramid power. We are definitely to the point where we know there's something to it. People who have learned to meditate have learned the power of a pyramid, how it can block out outside forces and radiations, causing you to be able to concentrate better and raise your own awareness, your own consciousness. That certainly does work. But apparently, that the pyramids were also used for other things, for teleportation and protection and other things that they used. So, but she didn't want to take this much farther. But here we have some evidence that the pyramids, at least the Great Pyramid and two others just like it, were built a long time back, 73,300 years back, actually. She said that the pyramids sat for a long period of time with no one really paying any attention to them after they were built. During the time of the Great Flood, which she says our modern scientists are off about 1,000 years on the time of it, that it was actually over 10,000 years back to the time of the Great Flood, 300 years previous to the time of the Great Flood, there was in the Egypt area, there where the pyramids are, there was a king named Saluk, who had a son named Sarid, S-A-U-R-I-D, and his son, Sarid, had the gift of future vision and could easily see things coming to pass in the future. And at one point, he saw a very destructive thing. He saw a great comet hit the earth, causing the earth to actually roll over, great storms, lots of water, where the ocean would jump out of its bed and roll over the land. And he saw his country land in Egypt buried in water. He told his father about this. His father, who was very aware of his future vision capabilities, called together other astrologers and scientific minds of his time to offer their opinion on what his son had seen. And they agreed that yes, and it would probably happen, and they felt very strongly, based on their abilities in astronomy, that there would be a large comet probably hit the earth about the time period that his son had said. So King Saluk ordered that the Great Pyramid begin to be prepared for the possibility of this catastrophe. And in so doing that, apparently they remodeled the pyramid again. I was told over at Billy's house that the pyramid originally had gold on it, that it was gold covered. Now, what they did, the gold was gone apparently by this time and been stripped off by someone, we don't know who. And that they, King Saluk's people, began to cover it with lime mortar so it would be waterproof when the great floods came. Well, they did that. They even left inscriptions on the pyramid so the people over the next 300 years would also know what was going to happen and what the pyramid was for. And at the time that the great flood actually happened, the people of Egypt actually did hide out inside the Great Pyramid underground in the underground city that had been dug out and built down below where Billy's already visited. And they stayed down there while until the waters receded. So the pyramid was actually used for that, and that's how it became covered with the limestone and how it was remodeled over 10,000 years ago. It was stripped of its limestone later on, and it's been remodeled a couple of times apparently after that, but its origin was over 73,000 years back and had nothing to do with the Egyptians. The Egyptians, of which King Saluk was an Egyptian, was responsible for resurfacing and recoating it with limestone. Hence, this is probably where the idea that the Egyptians actually built it came from. They didn't really build it. They just kind of remodeled it. Another thing that Edward was thinking about was horses and animals, and she picked that out of his thoughts too, and commented that the horse did not originate in Europe, as modern scientists and archaeology think, but actually the horse originated on the continent of America. that there was, way back over 50,000 years ago, there was a large settlement of extraterrestrials, and this was the time period of Pelagon, his people. They brought the horse to Earth, and because this was the continent that they lived on. That the horse then was very common and very popular on the American continent. The great wars that broke out later on and destructed that area, the horses on the American continent all disappeared, leaving the horses that were also in the European and Asian continent, leading archaeologists to believe that that's where the horse originated, but it didn't. It actually originated in America. And she said the horse back then was called a Hipparion. Or Hipparion, I'm not sure exactly how it would be pronounced. It's Hipparion. She says, as evidence of some of the great wars and some of the very destructive devices that had been used by ETs in the past on Earth, we could look to Death Valley. The Death Valley was the scene of a great war at one time where terrible weapons that dissolve things were used at that time, and that's why it's all flat and out there. The dissolving weapons, literally just some sort of particle beam something or other that they used, unlike just an explosion where you blow things to bits, these weapons just dissolved things and they were gone. Okay, at this point, we're at a point after 6 days where they've been on several travels through historic times and so forth that Ascot explains to Edward and to Jitshi that she feels that they are now both very prepared to go back into the time of Jesus Christ, Emmanuel, and that their education at this point now should serve them well so they will better understand, and it is time for Edward to actually meet Emmanuel. At this point on the tapes, I was a little quandary whether or not I should go on with this or not, but what I'm going to do is I'm not going to continue on with the time travel back into the year 32 right here with Edward, because I want to tie that together with the rest of the information about the Talmud of Manuel, the writings of Manuel, on two separate tapes. And those are in your tape set. So what I'll do here is I'll just kind of tell you a little bit about the general overview and what happened to Jitshi, and then we'll go over it again more in detail, and I'll tell you all about the conversation that Edward, young Edward's going to have with Emmanuel on the other tape set. Well, they do go back to the year 32. They're there for 4 days. When they get there, you have Ascot, Edward, and Jitshi is still with him. By this time, Jitshi has had a major mind change about life and what is real and creation and what's really historically gone down on our planet. He's seen the truth of things now for quite some time, and a lot of changes have gone on in his head, so he's pretty much ready now to make a trip back to the year 32 also. They make the trip. They're there for 4 days. One of the problems that Billy had was his hair. He had just had a haircut before they had gone on this trip and had short hair, which apparently was very unusual in those times. That most people just let their hair grow all the time, and I suppose they did because they really didn't have barbers, or it was just the style at the time to let your hair grow. And not to mention many people and believe that long hair facilitates personal strength. And I think that was a belief during those time periods. It was probably just an excuse not to get a haircut. But for whatever reason, most people had long hair at the time, and so it was out of place. So Ascot got some robes that had hoods on it, kind of like a monk sort of look, and that's what they wore during the time period. And because the language at the time, Aramaic, they did not understand, they were still using language translators around their belt so they could understand people of the time they were in. They were there for 4 days. I don't know exactly where they sat down, but they wandered around from area to area and wound up close to the Mount of Olives, where Edward does have a conversation with Emmanuel. Jitshi's with him all the time, taking all of this in. When they actually get there, Jitshi gets very nervous about the fact that he's actually going to meet Jesus Christ. And this could be a very heavy thing for someone who has worshipped and has had the concept for years that this man, Jesus Christ, is actually the Lord of the universe and the creator of all men and all the other, you know, things that are exaggerated by a Christian religion, when in fact he was just a real man like the rest of us. And now it's turning out that he wasn't even called Jesus Christ, he was really called Emmanuel. So when they get there, Jitchy is kind of overcome, and he's getting excited again. He's getting a little out of hand. And Ascot and Edward and Jitchy are standing by the road, and Emmanuel and his followers are walking towards them. And Jitchy's going a little berserk. You know, he's getting a little excited. He's losing control a little bit. And Edward just pops him once right on the nose, gives him a short chop right in the face. And Jitchy just calms right down, and his nose is bleeding a little bit. And Ascot thought that was the most unusual way to handle human behavior. And it was about that time that Emmanuel walks up, who seemed to be expecting the talks, says hello to Ascot. Apparently he had known Ascot and been visited by her several times before, and turns to Jitchy very calmly and suggests that Jitchy go over and sit down with his followers, who are sitting down beside the road there, and that they would take care of him. And they do stay there for a while, and Edward has his conversation, which we'll go into in length on the other tape. And then they get back into the ship, and they return. Jitchy, other than that, never does not speak with Emmanuel. Just met him for a moment there, was about it. And they return in the ship, and they go back to Jordan, where they never really see Jitchy again. And so Jitchy got an opportunity there just by virtue of being in the right time at the right place. He got to see a lot and go on the travels with him for that entire six-day time. Okay, we're going to move forward in time on our own here now. We've been talking about Edward's travels with Ascot back in the year 1956. After those travels, he continued on and went into India and roamed around many different countries. He had a few other contacts with Ascot. And there are some old pictures in black and white in India that Billy took of her ship and inside of her ship looking down at the earth. Those pictures aren't too common. They're not too common around. And I generally show them in my slideshow because people really haven't seen them very much.
Sure.
But his contacts after a while with Ascot were mostly telepathic towards the end, and then he didn't see her again for the longest period of time, except, of course, when he was reunited with her for just a small while he visited the great spacer of the Pleiadians. Well, let's move back up now. We're up to 1975 again, October 20th, and Billy's having his 36th contact that has gone on now since over a 10-month period. So it's been 10 months, and he's had 36 contacts, so you can see they're happening quite regularly here. All in all, there's going to be over 135 of them before they actually stop. Okay, he's now having contacts with Semyasi. He's now known as Billy, so I can remember to call him Billy all the time instead of Edward. Beginning in 1975, he started using the name Billy for everything. Okay, at this particular contact, Semyasi seems to be a little upset, and because numerous times they've quizzed Billy about his public speaking, and Billy keeps saying he's gonna, and then he says he's not gonna. That he's just not cut out for it and he can't do it, so he's going to get his friend Hans Jacob to do it. And he's been working with Hans, apparently, to do some public speaking. And Billy writes his speeches out, word for word, more or less so Hans can read them, I suppose, is the general idea. And they've been working on some speeches, and Hans, apparently, is kind of chickening out and has written a letter back to Billy. And the letter he would like for Billy to take to Semyasi and read to her, because it's stating all the reasons that he doesn't want to do the speaking. In particular, most of the reason is the fact that he feels that the information is too harsh, that it's going to be too shocking for people to hear many of these things, that it will be very disturbing to them. And he's probably right. You can't just show up somewhere at a meeting and start talking about things and telling people, well, this is what life is, and there isn't any God the way you think of it, and everything you know is wrong. Well, that's not exactly how you approach people. But on Billy's hand, he's telling Hans that the truth can be very harsh, and quite often when people are led astray, that to hear the truth about things can be rather shocking. That's also true. But there are ways to present information so people don't feel challenged and threatened. I mean, after all, just like Ascot says, we're all on our own path of evolution, and even though you hear somebody say something, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to believe it. We're all working on different things at different times, so it's important always when you present information, you present it just as an inspiration. And just for what it really is, it's just words of information. It's not part of anybody's life yet. They haven't experienced it. So people who are open-minded, and remember, be open-minded, it's a sign of intelligence. It's okay to listen to things. Anytime you feel yourself getting too locked into something, too dead set on something, you're probably getting a little closed-minded, and you want to be cautious. You may have run across some absolute truth that you can now keep for now on, and that's good to hang on to. But in many cases, people get very hard-headed about things which are incorrect anyway, and it's very hard to get them loose from it. So I can appreciate Hans's problem, especially in Europe. I've had my own experiences with people in Switzerland and Germany and a little closed-mindedness here and there, so I can understand what he was up against. Well, anyway, Billy has shown up at the contact with a letter from Hans stating that he doesn't really want to do this, but before he gets a chance to say anything, Semyasi is rambling on about how disappointed they are that Billy's not doing any public speaking, that he has jeopardized the mission. They're 10 months into the mission, and he's not moving ahead with this, so they've decided to put Billy on probation, that they're not going to see him for a month. It'd be sometime in November, so he has time to think this over. And that they feel they've been deceived somehow by Billy, because he has said all along that he was going to do public speaking and get the information out to the public, and he's not done this. Well, Billy, of course, he stops her and he calms her down, because she seems to be a little excited. And he calms her down and explains that he has been trying. And here's a letter from Hans explaining what he's doing. And she reads the letter and she's really kind of taken back by it a little bit and surprised that Hans is taking the attitude that he is. Because you got to remember, the Pleiadians, even though they're older than us, have higher technology, that doesn't mean they understand us that well. They don't live in the same kind of morality. They don't have the same kind of problems, especially social problems and social pressures like we do. Hans has got a tough problem here. ETs have come and educated Billy. They have not educated Hans. Billy's just giving all this information, writing a speech out for Hans, and expects Hans to go out like a little robot in front of a crowd and read this stuff off. Well, that'd be a tough job, especially since it's not Hans's truth. Hans hasn't had the benefit of all the experiences that Billy has, so it's not true for him. It's just secondhand information. He may not even believe in a lot of it yet. So far, to him, it may just be information. Well, at any rate, Semyasi's upset by the letter. She goes back to the beam ship with Billy, and they get Ptah on the screen there. They're kind of having a conference call of some type. And she reads the letter again to Ptah, and Ptah understands, and he comments, he understands Hans's situation, his problem, but he also understands that Hans is in his letter, apparently kind of twisted things his own way too, and has accused the Pleiadians of doing things that they haven't, and he's accused Billy, and he's calling Billy names and so forth, that he's this and he's that, so Hans has gotten a little excited on his own also. So Ptah just calms everybody down and says, well, that's fine. If Hans doesn't want to do it, we understand. Everybody has to make their own decisions, and he's not particularly upset by it at all. As a matter of fact, he seems to have a very highly evolved, open-minded view towards all people and understands that people have different problems with different things in life, and that's okay. We all just kind of have to follow our own path. I know for myself, it was a big lesson for me younger in life when I finally dawned on me one day that we do have to give everybody space to be themselves. And when we can start looking at somebody else as just an individual spirit on their own path without any prejudice, when we quit looking at them materially, when we look at them just as a spirit of nature or a spirit of God, whatever you want to call it, on their own path, then you can start to appreciate them. You almost find a little humor in looking at someone and seeing what they're doing with their life. But then you don't feel prejudice and anger. I've always kind of been like that. And it was refreshing for me in this material to find that attitude even more reinforced. I don't always find in the contact notes where the Pleiadians are particularly aware of this, even though they say it. But they seem to have pushed a lot of on Billy, telling Billy how important it is that he do things and leaning on him by telling him, you know, that the world is going to go bad if you don't perform this mission and the whole world is waiting on you. And there's a lot of pressure on Billy to perform back in these times. So it's not hard to understand why he's had the difficulties that he has in life. Well, anyway, they read the letter of Hans and so forth, and after the Ptah reads the letter and responds to it to Billy, then Billy understands a little bit better, and everybody seems to be a little calmed down, but still, Billy's not getting that in the public, And the information isn't getting out. So far, it's just in his house and a small group of people that come and read it there, just his friends. And Semyonovsky reiterates that, you know, they're trying very hard to get information out, and they really do feel love for the earth person. They live in a very loving, happy, kind of blissful society. And they really don't understand us that well. You know, they don't have hate, anger, prejudice, and jealousy on their world like we do. They are kind of more like Spock-like, like Spock in a blissful meditation, just kind of a even-tempered, blissful sort of person, is the impression I get about them. And they have trouble understanding how to relay information and expect reactions from us, the earthworms. And I suppose that our logic and our attitudes sometimes are quite a surprise to them. I think they can't understand why Billy just doesn't go out on the street corner and everybody will listen. Well, as they've been speaking so much about Hans, and they're in the beam ship, Semyonovsky wants to show Billy something kind of unusual. She says, quite often, because they have trouble understanding Earth people and people in other worlds when they're studying them, and I do believe that part of the Pleiadian contacts were probably mostly just like an experiment on their end. There was only a handful of the Pleiadians that actually had the contacts with Billy. It was not like the whole Pleiadian race came here to make contact with us. There was just a few of them. So I think it was kind of experimental on their side, too, to see, you know, to try to learn more about how to understand us. So there's a lot of different ways to look at these Pleiadian contacts. She says one of the devices that they have on board the ship is a device that actually can read the conscious mind and the subconscious mind of someone and even look into their future a little bit. Apparently, the ability to see the future or future visions is within all of us, that we are really creating our future as we go along. And as proof of that, she showed something to Billy. She says, watch this. And there's a little device that looked kind of like a world globe or a round ball in the ship. And she put her hand on it and she says, now think of Hans, which she does. And she saw Hans on the screen. Billy says, well, I can read that screen. And apparently what you see on the screen is some sort of symbols and so forth. And these are symbols that Billy had somehow learned in meditation when he was younger. Things that had been opened up in his mind about sign and symbols and what they mean and how to translate them into language. Billy begins to read some of the symbols on the screen and he says, I understand that. You're looking at Hans on this ball. And she says, yeah, I am. And he says, well, wait a minute, that's not Hans now, that's Hans in 2 days, right? And she was surprised that he understood the symbols actually as well as he did, to many Earth human beings, because it allows them to control them.